Support for Midday Matters on WBOI is provided by Christine and Ed Schaefer, broker realtors with Northeastern Group Realty. Trust the professionals with proven performance online at christine-ed.com, the Schaefer team. And Travel Leaders, proud supporter of public broadcasting, featuring Alaskan cruises and European holidays. Travel Leaders, making vacations monumental. Online at travelbetterindiana.com. Good afternoon. The time is 12:06. I'm Sarah D'Elia, sitting in for Sean Beeter today. We'd love for you to be a part of today's Midday Matters Outer Spaces, so get ready to give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matter. You can post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm joined in the studio today by our gardening guru, Doug Hackbarth.
Good afternoon.
And Jason Kissel from Acres. Thank you so much for coming, guys.
You're welcome.
So we're going to start off today's show with you, Jason, and kind of get an update on some of the nature-related news that's been going on and some that NPR has reported on.
Sure. You know, what I thought we'd discuss today is I've paid attention to the nature-based stories that have come across the station and through the national, to the NPR. Mm-hmm. And really, I thought maybe we could discuss some of those and any that the listeners want to talk about that and really look at the story behind the story.
Yeah.
You know, we report on very many things, and then that topic has an interest, but there's always a larger story behind it. And so when I hear nature news in the news, it's always interesting to me, one, what makes the news, and then two, you know, is there a larger issue that's behind that story that's being reported?
Mm-hmm.
One of the examples that was right after the last time I was on this show was there was a lot of NPR coverage of designing buildings to reduce bird deaths. You know, we've all experienced at our own home, bird runs into a window, it's dazed, and sometimes it flies off, or sometimes it hits so hard that it's just dead.
Mm-hmm.
It hits the glass and falls down. And so there's a really big story, a really great work that's being done to create windows and design buildings from even from the initial architecture stage to make sure that we can design buildings that minimize those bird deaths. And so, you know, putting things that humans can't see in the glass and the angle of the glass and things like that to reduce those bird deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's great. It's great that that's going on. But again, when I hear those stories, I think, you know, what problem are we really trying to address? That problem addresses almost more of a human need than a bird need, because we just simply don't like to come up to our place of business or outside our window and see dead birds.
Right.
And so we're addressing that, you know, through building design and things like that. And they were talking about how much would it cost to retrofit a single high rise in New York?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was mainly based in New York. And, you know, the estimates were a couple million per building. And I got to think, you know, how much more value we could do if we were really doing this for birds by looking at the larger impact of birds. You know, what is the true thing that's really hurting birds? And it's mainly habitat loss, you know, not only in the United States, but in their breeding areas and their migration routes and things like that. And what if that same effort was focused in on that also?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really looking at, you know, is our best money spent on designing new windows? And it's good that it's being done, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And there are people doing habitat loss, such as Acres and other groups around the world. But it just strikes me, you know, that we tend to pay attention to topics because we see them.
Right.
We get sad when we see that dead bird outside the window, and so we want to do something about it. And so maybe we put stickers on the windows or pictures so they can see them better. But what we don't often get as sad about, even though it's a bigger issue, say at my house, 5 birds die per year. You know, and I feel bad about those 5 birds. What I don't feel bad about, because I don't see them, is the hundreds of birds or thousands of birds who will never have the chance to run into my window because they've gone extinct or they've lost habitat and their population has declined so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really bringing the awareness that, yes, birds hitting the window are a problem, and we see that. But what's the larger problem behind bird death? Is it running into windows? Sure, that's some. But the much larger issue is really birds dying because they don't have anywhere to call home.
Right.
Or they go back to a breeding ground that they've gone to generation after generation, and now we've turned it into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just interesting when we hear these stories to think about what is, maybe is there a larger picture behind what gets reported?
Yeah. Are there any, you know, short-term solutions if you find that, I mean, maybe if you can tell that the increase of birds that have died because they've hit your window, or if you've noticed an increase in that, what can you do? If you're somebody that's already living in that house, are there any easy solutions for the everyday homeowner?
Sure. You know, and I think Audubon Society and those societies that deal specifically with birds, they probably have all kinds of things on their website on mm-hmm. how to make your home more bird friendly, mm-hmm. not only from adding feeders and things like that, but to make sure that you're reducing those deaths. A large one is just trying to declaw your cat or keeping your cat away from the birds. You know, they likely kill much more birds than birds hitting the windows. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the stickers that you put on your window, you know, birds are really just see windows sometimes, especially when they're in a shaded area, just as a passage. And so they assume they can fly through this mm-hmm. thing.
It's probably the reflection of the sky.
Yeah.
They just think they're flying right on through.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they see their reflection and start fighting with the window because they think it's something else. And so there's simple things to do, such as pulling the drapes, you know, putting things on the window so they see them and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are. And again, if you go to any group that's really dedicated to birds specifically, they'll have even more suggestions than mm-hmm. I can think of. Mm-hmm. So.
All right.
Yep.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about on your list. Are there similar problems with the line I want to draw is that we're not really thinking about birds until we see one that's unfortunately dead. And kind of, is that the same thing with black bears? We're going to transition and talk a little bit about them. We don't really think a lot about them until we see one because they've walked into our grocery store, or they've had to be put down because they've come too close and might be a danger. What's going on in the world of news and environment with black bears?
Yeah, you know, it's really true with any species. You know, it's the things that we run into on a daily basis that we tend to pay attention to more. And that's very logical. There's nothing wrong with that. But what that does, you know, when we're not thinking about the things we don't see, we don't know what we're missing, if that makes sense. And so when we see a bird, you know, that's dead, mm-hmm. We're not seeing the other ones that weren't born because they didn't have the opportunity.
Right.
And the same thing with, you know, there was a story about the black bear entering a grocery store. Pretty mm-hmm. typical. These things come up, you know, some bear gets awfully friendly with people and the people don't like that. And then, you know, they go. And we view that as a bear problem, mm-hmm. you know. But then if we step back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, we went into, I forget exactly where this was. I think Idaho somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we step back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, we chose to go into bear country as people and we like the area. We like the fact that there's bears there because they probably liked a lot of forest and we liked the forest. Mm-hmm. And so we go carve out our little space within there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, our expectation is that, well, wait a minute, this is our home now.
Right.
So bears and critters and snakes, and you shouldn't belong here anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. But the wildlife doesn't get that memo. You know, they don't know. You know, they've come to this area for so long that they assume that this is still part of my range.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of viewing it as a bear problem, you know, if that bear goes in the grocery store, the normal thing is you tranquilize it, you move it out and hope it doesn't come back.
Right.
It comes back again, you do the same thing, and if it keeps coming back, it's labeled a nuisance bear. And mm-hmm. so you euthanize it. And so again, from a public health standpoint, that's a perfect thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at it from a nature standpoint, it would be very similar to me going home tonight, someone else camping in my house and saying, well, wait a minute, this is my house now. I expect you to leave. And if
right.
you don't, I'm going to call the authorities. And so the authorities come out and say, you need to leave. Someone
right.
else has moved in here. They've taken your home. You need to accept that and leave, you know. And so I leave. Then I get back and staying at the hotel and think, wait a minute, that's not fair. That was my home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back there and claim my home again.
Yeah.
And so I go back and the police say, you know, you need to leave. And so if we look at it that way, we can start to understand how some of these interactions occur and why they occur.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not that we shouldn't build homes, not that we shouldn't, not in every natural area has to stay a natural area. I understand
right.
the value of homes and towns and grocery stores. But we just need to at least have the perception that we are the invaders in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went into bear territory because we like to share that space. And so it's just funny that because we always treat the bear as the intruder rather than us as the intruder.
Right.
So it's just really looking at these stories from more of a nature's perspective.
Yeah. Are there any initial steps that, you know, people who are thinking of developing homes and other built-up property that's going to be taking up natural habitat from bears or, you know, particular birds that, you know, what's the solution? Because people do need to build more houses.
Sure.
You know, what can we do to kind of make everybody happy? Is that possible?
It is possible. And, you know, again, we need to grow. There's cities are growing, population is growing, and we've got to accept that. You know, we are the biggest influence as humans on the natural environment. And so we can choose to develop well, or we can choose to develop poorly, you know. And so a lot of communities do it at a landscape level. You look at your county plans and say, you know, does it allow for areas that are going to be more conservation minded than others? You know, let's put all of our high density area here. And let's leave some areas that are more undeveloped areas, and just in general and in planning. Then you get down to the real nitty gritty where someone's going to put in a subdivision, you know, and what was a natural area, or, you know, say it's an agricultural field or a forest. There are ways that you can make that development more friendly. And a lot of them are pretty simple, by leaving some of those natural areas as corridors. So say, for example, you're going to develop a 40 acre lot and it's surrounded by the rest of it's all natural areas still. And so by leaving some of that area as a connection between those two natural areas that are going to remain, that's greatly beneficial. And so a lot of developers are really seeing that and using that as a sales pitch for their development to say, hey, we're going to put this development within a semi-natural area, and we're going to try to keep that natural area intact, which is going to provide you great bird viewing opportunities. You'll see the deer go by, you'll see, you know, and so it's a sales point for them. And so they'll often put a hiking trail through that area. And so it'll be a kind of a common area. Instead of the common area being a mowed strip of grass like they typically are in some, it'll be more of a natural area. And so there are ways to, you know, to do best of both, you know, to try to go ahead and get the development that you need to put in, but at least being sensitive. And there's, again, there's whole organizations and whole trade groups and everything else that, you know, the green building movement. It's not just how to make your home more efficient, but how to develop with that in mind. And being able to do stormwater runoff within your system. You know, you can do that through ditches and through underground type of things or retention ponds. Or you can do that through a more natural environment that's going to allow more diversity of plant and animal life through constructed wetlands and things like that, drainage swells rather than drainage ditches. So there really is. And a lot of developers are really getting excited about that because they see that it's a great sales pitch that actually helps them sell the homes if they say, we're doing this in a way that we're not just going in, bulldozing the lot, and starting from the flat. We're going to look at what's there and try to put our development in that complements that.
Great. We're going to take a short break here on Outer Space's Midday Matters on WBOI, but we're going to be back with more in just a few moments.
Hi, I'm Julia Meekin. What's new on this week's Meet the Music? Everything. Guitar vocal originals with Danny House, positive rap from Venom, and the folk funk rockitude of Pliers. That's Thursday night from 7 to 9 here at 89.1 FM or listen online at NIPR.FM. A 2-hour serving of homegrown delights here on Meet the Music.
I came home 3-2 win.
From Coke to Toyota, product placement on TV is ubiquitous. The National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy negotiates its own kind of placement on shows in which teens have sex.
You two, out of bed. I'm going to show you where this can lead to. I'm your ghost of teen pregnancy future.
Issue placement in Hollywood later on All Things Considered from NPR News. All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Welcome back to Outer Space's Midday Matters here on WBOI. The time is 12:21. If you'd like to join the conversation, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. And so, Jason, we're kind of doing a review of some nature-related news that's been featured in NPR and other news sources. And one thing that's definitely been a huge problem in various places over the summer are wildfires.
Yep.
So let's start there.
Okay. Yeah, you know, we tend to lump fires, hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding and thing, and we call them natural disasters. Mm-hmm. But again, we call them natural disasters because they hurt or affect human things. And so, you know, really, if you're looking at it from a natural standpoint, there's nothing wrong with fires that mm-hmm. go through. In fact, a lot of ecosystems, especially out west, rely on fires. We've talked about that on this show before, where there's many pine species and other species that won't release seeds until a fire has gone over the top of them. They're called serotonous species, meaning that their seeds won't open unless they have the heat of a fire. Mm. And so a lot of the forest communities out west and some of the even grassland communities really require fire. And so a fire, a wildfire, is not a natural disaster. It's a natural feature that the natural ecosystem requires. It only becomes a disaster when we put things in the fire's way. And don't get me wrong, I think that there's, you know, I'm not minimizing the loss of homes or definitely not the loss of life that's, mm-hmm. you know, comes from sometimes these fires. And so that's why we suppress them. And I'm glad we do. I don't want to be misread. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it just from a natural standpoint, if humans weren't in the mix, or if we built our structures to accommodate fire like the animals do, it wouldn't be a natural disaster, nor would it be a human disaster. Mm-hmm. We are smart enough people to build fire homes, or we're smart enough to build dwellings that could withstand a fire if mm-hmm. we wanted to. Mm-hmm. If I lived in a fire-prone area, I could design a house that would withstand a fire. It would likely be underground, you know, and so you could design a very nice underground home to withstand a fire. Mm-hmm. Fire runs over the top of it. You wake up the next morning and say, oh, great, it's burned over, and things start to come back up.
I don't have to mow today.
Exactly. We choose to live, to put ourselves in harm's way because we like the aesthetics of above ground homes. And so we willingly make ourselves vulnerable to fire, tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But we often don't realize that that's what we're doing. Well, mm-hmm. I want a home. And well, the typical thing is you build this structure above ground and it's susceptible to these things. Mm-hmm. And so again, if we look at it from a natural standpoint, you know, a fire running through a home, hopefully we've evacuated and everything else, that is a natural occurrence as a fire, but it's unnatural that it destroyed something that we own. Mm-hmm. And so we say, oh, it's the fire's fault that the fire burnt my home. Well, no. I mean, the fire burnt something that you knew had the capability of burning. And so that's why we have fire insurance. That's why, we, you know, that's...
Right.
If you lived in an underground home and made it fireproof, that fire wouldn't have been a disaster.
Yeah.
And so it's really looking at these natural disasters, and are they really natural disasters or are they human-induced disasters? Because we choose to put fire-prone homes mm-hmm. and structures in fire-prone areas. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't make fireproof homes because we like the look of a non-fireproof home. Nothing wrong with that. We mm-hmm. just need to realize that we're putting ourselves in that danger. Mm-hmm. So again, is it a natural disaster? No. Is it a human-induced disaster when we put inappropriate things in the path of a fire? Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. So a home is an inappropriate thing in that instance then?
Well, you know, again, we know the risk, but mm-hmm. a lot of times we don't think about that. Mm-hmm. You know, here in this area, we are prone to tornadoes, not as mm-hmm. much as in Tornado Alley, but we're prone to tornadoes. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to take that risk out, we could all live in underground homes. We know that. We know that that would help save our structure in a tornado. Mm-hmm. We choose not to because we like the light coming through the windows, you know, and we like this other thing. And so we choose to put ourselves at risk of tornado. Mm-hmm. by the homes that we build. Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we take a risk every time we go on the road or do anything else. We're used to that.
Right.
But once a tornado comes through and flattens our house, we blame the tornado.
Right.
we could have prevented that. And so instead of saying, well, shoot, I knew a tornado was going to come and hit this house within the next 300 years sometime, mm-hmm. but we blame the tornado. So it's just our nature to do that. We want to blame something else.
And I think probably the best example of this is how many places are built in hurricane areas.
Yes.
Mm. High-rise condos and everything in the hurricane areas. I was recently in Pensacola, Florida, on mm-hmm. the Pensacola Beach, and they were just building the most beautiful homes right on the sand, right at the edge of the water. And I thought, well, man, what's this going to be like when a hurricane hits? Well, there have been two of them since then.
Sure. Yep.
I just wonder what happens to those places. I'm sure they're built hurricane-proof, but how good is that?
Right. And yeah, how hurricane-proof is hurricane-proof? That's what I'd want to know if I was living on one of those beaches.
But that's another great example. You know, hurricanes, again, are natural systems, and they don't affect the natural ecosystems. They're used to that. You know, if you look at the Gulf lines, they used to have these wonderful wetlands that would buffer the storm surge. We've removed those because we like to put home fronts right on the water. And
right.
so we've taken that barrier off. And so when these storm surge comes in, they come in their full effect, and they flood all these things that we put in a floodplain. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that it's a floodplain. It may be only a floodplain when it's a hurricane, but it's a floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, it's us choosing to create a human-induced disaster, but we call it a natural disaster. We could have prevented any damage from hurricanes if we just don't live in those areas. But mm-hmm. we choose to live there. Again,
right.
nothing wrong with that. We just have to be aware that we are causing the disaster, not the natural phenomenon that we know is going to occur. We mm-hmm. know there's going to be several hurricanes a year, and we know what they do. They
right.
bring high wind and high water.
Mm-hmm.
So if we build in areas that don't get that high water, we've solved that disaster before it happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very rare for what we call a natural disaster to actually kill people.
Mm.
It's normally the things that we built that kill us. Let's use tornadoes, for example. You don't hear of many stories, now they do occur, where the tornado actually sucks up the people and the tornado itself kills people.
Right.
It's normally our structures that kill us.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing that we built not to withstand the storm that falls on us and crushes us. Or it's debris from our neighbor's house mm-hmm. that all of a sudden gets airborne and hits someone and injures them that way.
Right.
And so, again, it's just really looking at these things. You know, after a tornado, you don't hear reports of 10,000 deer are dead. You know, you don't see deer lying everywhere. You don't see rabbits lying everywhere. You don't see crows lying everywhere after a tornado. They choose a dwelling that is safe during a tornado.
In their holes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they choose areas, or they choose to be mobile. We tend not to leave our homes during storms. You hear it all this, you know, hurricane. I'm not going to leave my home. I've withstand this hurricane, mm-hmm. and I'm going to stick with my home.
Right.
That's what puts them in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the storm. They could have chose to leave, but our belongings, we become so attached to them that we don't even think to leave them during a storm event. And so the dwellings, these things that we create, is what kills us. It's not the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, when I always hear natural disasters, I always think in the back of my mind, well, it's not a natural disaster. It's really a human-induced disaster that we have felt okay with putting ourselves in that risk. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes we lose that battle.
You know, Jason, as my wife and I get a little older and near retirement age, often we say to each other, well, where do you want to move to and retire, and where would it be safe? Seriously, we say this.
Yep.
Where would it be safe?
Yep.
There is no safe place.
No, there's not.
Maybe underground, like you said, but
yeah.
there is no safe place. Mm-hmm. There's no, there's everything happens.
Yep.
Earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes. There is no safe place. The Mississippi River can flood anywhere up and down the country.
Yep.
I think they'd like to see a little more water in the Mississippi right now, but I don't think there's a safe place, so I guess you just have to pick something.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm
and
not
hope for the best.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not advocating for people to live in these underground homes that are bomb resistant and tornado resistant. I don't live that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live in an above ground home that's typical and prone to fire and prone mm-hmm. to tornadoes and everything else.
Yeah.
What's the cost factor of an underground home compared to an up up on top home. What's the cost factor? Is there a lot more expense in building?
No, it's actually cheaper to build and much cheaper to maintain. You know, a lot of the underground homes have a layer of, you know, 5 to 6 feet of fill on top of the roof and around the structure. And normally there's one face that's exposed, kind of like a open basement where you have a lot of light coming in through there.
And it's usually pointed in a direction like not west.
Yep.
Normally facing northwest, south. Not southwest.
Yeah, so they can catch the light coming in. And they're so efficient because what they're doing is in the summer, the ground's staying around 52 degrees. And so they're getting automatic cooling. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, instead of being 10 degrees outside, hitting on the side of your house, you've got 52 degrees coming on the side
of
your house.
It's like a cave.
Yeah. And so they're very efficient. Became popular in the 70s during the energy crisis because people saw the energy efficiency of underground homes. And so I don't know why we haven't embraced that more. You know, it's safer, it's cheaper. But again, aesthetically, we just like to see those big houses, you know, above the ground. And it does allow a lot more light and things like that that we value. But there is a trade-off. And that's what we just have to understand is, you know, again, I choose for that trade-off. I like to have all the light coming in the window. And I'm okay with knowing that we're at risk if a tornado goes through. But we often don't acknowledge that risk. We often just...
Let's not build underground homes in flood areas because you're in big trouble.
That's true. That is a good point, Doug. Then we'll,
because I was just thinking there is one on Winchester Road, and it's not far from the river, but it's on fairly high ground.
Sure.
Yeah, and I have friends up in the Angola area that built an underground home 40 years ago.
Sure.
I think they still live in it.
Yep.
So then I guess, Jason, would you argue that it's, if you're going to do something like that, it's location, location, location?
It is. It's like anything else. You need to do your homework on is, are the soils compatible, you know, to do this? You know, and then again, all the other considerations that you would do, but it's not much more difficult than siding a normal house.
Well, it's just like building a fairly large basement.
Sure.
It's usually concrete walls poured and, like you said, covered with soil.
Yep.
And one end is exposed.
Yep.
Yeah. I've seen them.
Yeah. All right. They do exist. We're going to take a short break for the news, but when we come back, Jason and Doug are going to be answering tree, plant, gardening questions. So get ready to give us a call. 260-452-1185 is the number. You can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm.
On the next Fresh Air, life in an assisted living facility when you're decades younger than the average resident. We talk with Martin Bain. He moved into an assisted living facility 8 years ago in his mid-50s as a result of young onset Parkinson's disease. A former journalist and Zen monk, he now publishes a literary journal featuring writers in their 60s and older. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. Indiana University is investing $8 million to help develop and deliver online courses at its campuses statewide and extend the university's global reach. University officials say the IU Online Education Initiative will focus on creating undergraduate and graduate degree programs, providing online options for undergraduate courses with high enrollment, and exploring new methods of education. The initiative will also identify programs that can help Indiana improve its workforce development and help reduce the time it takes students to complete degrees. The $8 million will be spent over 3 years and will be used to hire additional designers and technicians, expand computer systems, and fund an office of online education. Money will also go to academic units on all campuses to develop online programs. Investigators examining last year's state fair stage collapse say Indiana has made significant progress in preventing future accidents. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, they also say the state still has work to do.
Representatives from Thornton Tomasetti and Witten Associates, the two independent firms that conducted stage collapse investigations, reviewed their findings Wednesday before a legislative study committee. They also gave brief evaluations of the temporary regulations the state has adopted since the stage collapse. Witten Associates building code expert Ann Von Waller says the state's safety measures are much better than they were a year ago.
It is requiring engineered plans. It's identifying the owner to have a lot of responsibility for what's going on here. It has emergency operations plans now required.
Von Weller says she'd like to see safety regulations with fewer exemptions and exceptions. State Fire Marshal Jim Greason, who helped develop the state's temporary regulations, says Von Weller's recommendations are reasonable and that the state doesn't have far to go to comply.
The rule itself has done a great deal to cover, obviously, a large majority, the vast majority of what was intended by the legislature and the commission when the emergency rule was written.
Witt and Associates also recommended the state ensure enforcement of its regulation is supported with adequate financial resources. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Scathing testimony was heard Wednesday regarding the way the Indiana Department of Child Services handles its child abuse hotline. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Dan Goldblatt reports, several lawmakers are hoping to improve the way neglected children are treated in the state.
Linda Hartley is a social worker who works with abused children and their families. She interacts with the Department of Child Services on a regular basis and came to the State House to give testimony to a group of legislators, judges, and law enforcement officials regarding the way she thinks the DCS operates in Indiana.
I think that there's a lack of professionalism, but first and foremost, I don't get a sense of really, that passion for protecting kids.
Similar sentiments were echoed by more than a dozen social workers, child advocates, former DCS employees, and relatives of abused and neglected children. Representative Cindy Noe chairs the interim study group. She says meetings like this were set up so lawmakers can enact legislation that creates a positive change within the department.
I think we're at a really unique point in time where we have an ability to intersect with DCS and other agencies that really touch these children and make some differences.
A representative from DCS declined to comment, saying that the hearings are for the public and for families to be heard. The next hearing for the interim study committee will be September 24th, where DCS officials will make a presentation to the group. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Dan Goldblatt.
And it's one win down and one to go for the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. WBOY's Doug Gruber has the results of last night's playoff series opener.
In the first game, the best of three series at Parkview Field, Fort Wayne took a first inning, 1-0 lead. Jason Asensio beat out an infield single, and Travis Whitmore's triple over the center fielder's head scored Asensio. Lansing didn't waste any time evening the score. Single runs in the second and third gave the Lugnuts a 2-1 lead. The Tin Caps rallied to take the lead in the fifth inning. Kyle Goodell led off with a walk. Tyler Stubblefield singled to right. Travis Jankowski singles to left, driving in Goodell to tie the score. The Tin Caps then went up 3-2 when the Lansing pitcher threw Jace Peterson's bunt past the third baseman, allowing Stubblefield to score. Fort Wayne added another run in the sixth, and Tyler Stubblefield's eighth-inning home run gave the Tin Caps a 5-2 win. The series now moves to Lansing tonight for Game 2. A Fort Wayne win will send the Tin Caps into the second round against the Lake County Bowling Green winner. A loss will result in Game 3 Friday night in Lansing. For WBOI News, I'm Doug Gruber.
And now back to Midday Matters with your host, Sarah DeLeo.
Welcome back to Outer Space's Midday Matters here on WBOY. We're opening up the phone lines now. If you have any gardening questions, plant questions, tree questions, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Sarah DeLeo, and I'm joined by Jason Kissel and Doug Hackbarth. Thank you both so much for sticking around to answer some questions.
You bet.
All right, well, let's get right to them. We have a caller online. Sorry, been dropped, but I think Stephen is online too. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thanks. Back in the 70s, I worked on the Senate staff of Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio. In touring the state of Ohio, one of the big complaints that I received from the people was that they could not get insurance for their underground homes. Probably things have changed since the 70s, but you were just discussing that. I thought I'd mention that to you.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because a lot of people don't realize that even if you have insurance flood insurance,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't cover basements.
Hmm.
People don't know that. I think it'll cover the heater and the hot water heater, the furnace. That's it. If you have a finished basement, a pool table, carpeting, none of that's covered. You can get coverage for it, but it's a separate policy. Even if you have flood insurance, mm-hmm. it's not covered.
Hmm.
And so that sort of goes right in line with his trying to get insurance for an underground home.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point.
It is. Is that a challenge that...
You know, I haven't heard that. There's several people that I know that do live in underground, and I never heard them mention that as a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it was because it was such a new... that they didn't develop the charts yet for it. You know, perhaps it's now considered more of a traditional built home, or mm-hmm. maybe not. Maybe there still is that issue.
I'm going to call a couple of my friends there that have these homes and ask them.
Interesting. 260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment. And you can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. And Doug, you brought along some really interesting factoids about poison ivy, which come across.
Well, poison ivy, you know, it's out there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's active even in the wintertime. It's always active. At any stage, any part of the poison ivy is active. The leaves, the stems, if you try to pull them up by the roots, if you try to pull them up, and they'll always snap and continue to grow back.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I think the only way to kill them is either with poison ivy killer. I don't know if you could put plastic over them in a hot, sunny area and cook them out. But then most of the poison ivy is not generally growing in hot, sunny areas. But it will grow about anywhere. Interesting facts, too, was the deal that the first time you touch it, it may not actually show up
mm-hmm.
for a week to 2 weeks. Once you have it, the next time you touch it, it'll show up immediately. I mean, within a day or two.
Uh-huh.
So very fast. Jason and I was talking during the commercial break. I am a firm believer that if you think you came in contact with the oils of poison ivy, that if you immediately go and wash your hands and your arms with hot soap and water,
mm-hmm.
you can wash a lot of that oil off before it gets you. And then if it does still get you, it won't be quite as bad as if you hadn't have done that. And plus, while it's on your skin,
mm-hmm.
you'll spread it
yeah.
to other parts of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to go and wash with soap and water and try to get it off your hands and arms, I'd wash them about 3 times before I went to the face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I'd want to make sure that my hands were clean before I started washing my face and neck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, the people who are really sensitive to that, there's even some soaps that you can buy that's specifically made to wash off that oil.
Uh-huh.
And there's even some things that you can put on before you get exposed. For most people, it's just a mild irritant. It itches for a few. But some people are really sensitive to it, and it really spreads quickly on them. So it's just like anything else. Some people are more sensitive. And there are products that you can put on even before exposure that
mm-hmm.
tends to help keep the oil from getting into your skin.
Mm-hmm.
One thing this time of year, too, to watch out for is a lot of people burn poison ivy without
yeah.
knowing. And again, when you're breathing that in,
mm-hmm.
your throat is very sensitive to those kinds of things. And again, if you're susceptible to that, you can actually get some of those oils transmitted that way. It's kind of
yeah.
uncommon, but you at least want to make sure that if you are going to do some burning, because poison ivy, a lot of people think of it as kind of a ground cover growing within the forest or on the edge of your property, but it really is a vine. And so you'll see it growing up trees, and it'll get almost, I've seen some that are 3 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, it's a grapevine, but these stick right to the tree.
Yes.
And so you'll see them. And a lot of people don't realize that that's poison ivy, and they'll just cut it up with their firewood and start
yeah.
burning it, or, you know, keep wondering, why am I getting poison ivy?
Yeah.
And, but it really can take a lot of different forms. If it stands alone in a forest and gills into a vining mode but can't find anything to latch onto, I've seen 2 examples, only 2, it's pretty rare, but it'll actually take a tree form.
Yeah.
It looks like a small tree where it's got a central stump
uh-huh.
and then these little feeler arms that normally go out to try to grab onto something. They never found anything, and so they kind of grow like branches.
Ugh.
And so you'll see this 10 to 15 foot tree, but it's actually a poison ivy tree.
That big.
I've only seen two of those
in my
life.
This article I have said up to 4 feet.
Yeah.
That's tall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting.
What's the best way to get rid of it then if you come across?
Well, you know, a couple of things. Number one, after you have it and after you've washed the oils away, mm-hmm. it's interesting to know that it will not spread further.
Right.
On you or on other people. However, you may keep popping out with it because of other reasons. Those other reasons, of course, I think most people know that it can get on your clothes and remain on your clothes, okay? And mm-hmm. and you could come back half a year later and touch that piece of clothing, you know, like if it was on your boots,
uh-huh.
and you can get poison ivy again. But here's the one that people should really be aware of that I wasn't. Your pets.
Mm.
Your dog goes running through the poison ivy. He's got it on the fur mm-hmm. of his coat. And when you pet that dog, you can get poison ivy from that. And then let's say you get it washed off and you didn't even know you had it, but you washed it off. And 2-3 days later, you touch the dog again or your neighbors touch the dog. It's like, how did I get poison ivy? I wasn't even in the woods.
Right.
Well, you petted, you know, you pet the neighbor's dog and you got it that way. I like to mention because... you know, I'm a big Mackinac Island fan. We go up there, and when you ride your bike around the island, the halfway mark, there's a little, there's a restroom area and then a place to buy snacks and set around picnic tables and whatnot. This goes into your topic, Jason, of coping with nature, because between the snack shop and the restrooms is a huge patch of poison ivy. Huge. And you're talking about families, kids running around. Most of them wear flip-flops, so their feet are exposed. And a lot of them have pets with them, okay? Yeah. And no one's going to tell that pet not to run through the poison ivy. And their nature way to cope with that is not to get rid of it. They put a sign in the bed that says, poison ivy.
There you go.
And I laugh at that every time. I think, oh, my gosh. And I can't stand to walk there. Because I see these kids, you know how they just run around without thinking. And I tell the parents, you know, that's a patch of poison ivy right there. You should really keep your child out of that.
Yeah.
But that puts you back into that natural thing where they're not going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
It's there. It's in the park. Just put a sign up.
Jason, do you have any recommendations on how do you actually handle the poison ivy to remove it in a safe way? That's not burning it because obviously that's bad. So and we know not to burn it. What can we do?
Yeah, you know, if it's in your yard or something and you do need to remove it, then again, the Purdue Extension Service is a good one to talk to as far as chemicals that might be more effective than others to mm-hmm. try to treat it. But yeah, again, when you're handling it, ideally you might just want to use disposable gloves or, you know, those kinds of things where you're touching it. You eradicate it, you put it in a trash bag, and then it's taken care of. And then mm-hmm. just throw those gloves away, you know, while you're doing it. And then wash your clothes, wash your hands, and then you should be okay.
Or throw them away.
Yeah, you
know, get out an old shirt that's got paint on it and say, this is it. After I do the poison ivy, it's trash.
But for most people, it's not, you know, it's not like you're going to catch it by just walking by it. Or, you know, and so it's, you know, it's nothing to be afraid of by any means. Some people are very sensitive to it, though, and so you just need to be cautious of it. And again, if you know you're exposed, like I said, just go wash as soon as you can. And normally you can just wash all those oils off. And I tend to get it right between my fingers because I obviously don't wash my hands well enough. You know, I wash the pads well and the back of my hands, but I always get it right in between my fingers there in that webbing.
Mm.
And it's just simply because I didn't wash my hands well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of common sense where if you know you were exposed or you may have been exposed, it's a good idea when you're coming in from doing your yard work just to go ahead and wash up. It's good hygiene anyhow.
So. Right. Yeah, definitely.
We had a listener write in jewel weed. Counteracts the poison ivy oil. You can just crush it against the skin, and you don't have to actually have the jewel weed plant. There's a very gentle and effective soap that she said she bought on at Do It Best on Illinois Road, and that's another jewel weed. Apparently,
jewel weed. Okay,
it's a natural remedy.
Yeah, and a lot of times it really is supposed to help too with stinging nettles, and they often grow in the same type of areas. And so, if you get stung by stinging nettles.
Yeah.
And the jewel weed right now, if you'll see it, it has these little orchid-looking orange flowers are beautiful. They're pretty tiny, maybe 3/4 of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look close at them, they are just beautiful. They're like this little hanging orchid with this really delicate hood to it. Mm-hmm. Just beautiful flowers that are blooming right now.
And that's the jewelweed?
Yes. And right now, poison ivy's got all these white berries. And so it's very easy to identify right now. It's, you know, it's the old, if it leaves a three, let it be kind of thing. And so you look for three leaves. And right now, the more mature vines and some of the ground cover varieties, too, have these white berries right now. And so it's another way to help identify it.
Okay.
It's good nasty stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned that burning nettles, you know, as a young person working in the greenhouse, we didn't use chemical weed killers whatsoever. I mean, I don't know why they might have had them. They didn't have good ones like paraquats, a terrible, terrible weed killer. It says right on the bottle, folks, anecdote, none. That's what it says. You don't want paraquat. Well, I don't even think they sell it much anymore. But I would be pulling weeds or whatever, and I'd hit one of those burning nettles. Oh, my gosh. But again, I'd go straight to the sink, wash with soap and water two or three times, and of course, don't scratch it then afterwards. It would be gone before the day was over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you didn't wash with the soap and water and you continually scratched it, you'd be on fire by the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So soap and water, first thing. And then, like you said, this poison ivy, it's an oil. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody has now heard that Dawn dishwashing soap is great against cutting oils. We keep a bottle right by the sink. And like yesterday, I poured gas in the lawnmower, and I go over and I hit it with Dawn and other soaps just to get it out of there. But and the pine trees, the pine branches and whatnot, sap all the time. You just breathe by them and you get sap on you. Jeez. So it, you know, it's good to get that off before you get it all over yourself. But poison ivy, it's an oil.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, so this is a plant that's going to survive all year round. I mean, we mostly think about it as summer because we're outdoors more. But
it goes dormant in the winter, but it still can affect you if you walk on it barefoot.
Right.
At any stage. Mm-hmm. Whether the leaves are on it or not, because the stems will get you.
Yeah, the stems and the vines still have that oil in them. It's just like they're part of their sap, and they're just their water conductive material. And so you still can contract it in the winter. It's not just through the leaves.
Okay.
But normally you're not out roaming around in it in the
Hopefully
winter
you're
time.
Not. Yeah.
that's why you don't usually get it in the winter.
Right.
But it's nasty stuff, and you can't, as I mentioned earlier, you can't just cut it off because it'll just branch out and come right back.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be killed to the root. You know, that's how Roundup was designed, was to spray on the foliage. It would go down into the root system and kill everything.
Right.
And it was a safe product because you can spray it on the poison ivy. You can come back a week or so later and plant anything, and it won't be affected by the weed killer, where some weed killers that are like total vegetation kill, you can't even plant back in there again for months. But something like the Roundup, where you can spray it, it goes and kills the entire root system. It gets absorbed and sucked right down through and pretty much eradicates it completely. Now, you know, a hard patch of poison ivy, you might have to treat it a few times to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Doug, you brought up a really interesting point earlier about, you know, maybe contracting poison ivy from a pet, a dog, a cat.
Yes.
I wonder what the precautions or what you need to do to your dog. I mean, obviously get them a bath. I don't know if there's anything that you could put in, you know, a dog or cat bath to make sure you get all that oil off.
Dawn.
Use it for anything.
Yeah, but you know, you have to think, I got poison ivy. Where would have I gotten it? And if you weren't outside or you weren't out in the weeds or anything, then you must have gotten it somewhere else. Either it's on a pet, a cat or a dog that you touched. You've got to figure out. And if there's nowhere else, then you're going to have to give that dog a bath and get that off of there. Because actually, if other people in your family are petting the dog, you know, people pet the dogs all the time. They're always rubbing up against you and whatnot. So you need to give them a bath for that reason, especially if poison ivy's coming up out of nowhere. So it's tough. I mentioned, too, that the people get the bumps and the blisters. And, you know, we've all seen a bad case of poison ivy, and the blisters might break, and you've got that oozy sap that comes out. You cannot catch poison ivy from that. It is not transferable once you wash the oils off of your skin.
Okay.
So a gentleman, I saw him. Oh, I had painted, and I had all kinds of funny-looking blue paint on me. Well, he went to shake my hand, and he sort of backed off, and I said, "It's just paint." And he says, "Oh, I thought it was poison ivy." He goes, "Oh, well, gosh. Go ahead." And he shook anyway, even though he thought it might have been a case of poison ivy. And interestingly enough, he wouldn't have been able to catch it anyway.
Right.
I did not know that. So, yeah. So it's not transferable that way.
Any other interesting facts you came across in your reading of poison ivy? Anything that surprised you?
Well, not anything more, but, you know, it changes color in the fall. It turns real bright red. It's colorful. It's kind of pretty.
Yeah. it's kind of goes back to the conversation we were having the first half of the show, Jason, with, like, you know, I guess poison ivy wouldn't be a problem if we didn't touch it.
Sure.
There you go.
You know.
So I wonder, is there any, you know, what good does poison ivy do?
Sure. You know, everything has its place.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a lot of animals can eat poison ivy without any harmful effects. You know, a lot of things aren't allergic to it at all for skin irritation. And I'm certain, although I don't know what insect, it's probably maybe a sole host for either some kind of an insect or one certain stage of an insect. And, you know, it's amazing when we look at any one plant in particular. We're going to have Acres is going to have a pawpaw presentation in a few weekends. And learning more about the Indiana pawpaw, you know, it's the only host plant for the tiger swallowtail, which is that yellow butterfly that we all are used to.
Yeah.
If there was no more pawpaws, we would have no more tiger swallowtails. It's the only plant that the caterpillar stage can eat. It's the only plant. And so, again, you know, I'm not sure what if poison ivy has specific hosts or particular insects or other animals that rely on it, but I'd be surprised if it didn't. And so, again, everything has its place, has its purpose.
Right.
Some plants irritate us, some plants we don't like, some plants we love because we eat them, you know, and other things. And so, you know, what's bad for us is definitely very good for something else. And so, again, we just have to look at it from that perspective. Yeah, it causes us some irritation now and then, but it has a larger role to play than just to irritate people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's not something that needs to be eliminated from our ecosystem.
No. But again, if it's in your backyard, it makes sense to remove it. You know, if it's in a nature preserve, we leave it alone. Or if it's in your woods, leave it alone.
Right. And it's not going to go extinct.
No, it's not likely.
No, it's a big, fast spreader. So if you eliminate it from your yard, it's not like you're destroying some kind of a plant life that could go extinct. I don't think that could hardly happen.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time that we have for today. So Doug and Jason, thank you so much for
joining us
today.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at our new website, nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Thanks so much for listening in today. Coming up at 1 o'clock, it's time for Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And next week, next Thursday, noon to 1, Sean Beter will be back for Outer Space's Midday Matters. From WH.